So this is a technically it's a security talk. It's actually a psychology talk disguised as a security talk. So basically, the first question is, why can't users get security right? It's pretty simple. Users are idiots. That's a quote taken straight off Slashdot. Basically, developers build secure applications. Users apply them incorrectly. Therefore, users are idiots. There's a comment at the bottom saying, you know, it's evolution at work. People are too stupid to use security, but the stupid ones will die out and the clever ones will survive. So that's a bit of an extreme position, but let's just say, okay, users are irrational. And we have to define irrational and rational. Rational is how geeks think users should behave. Irrational is not how geeks think users should behave. So basically, users are irrational because they don't follow some arbitrary behavior pattern that geeks define as how we wish users would behave. In fact, this kind of rational behavior does actually exist in rare cases in people with psychiatric disorders, and I'll get onto that in a minute. So security tells us a lot about how users behave, in particular cognitive psychology, which is how people think, how they make decisions, that sort of thing. It's generally ignored. There's a great quote there from someone who's kind of an authority on heuristic reasoning and decision making. And he says that many textbooks present the laws of logic and probability as a standard by which to measure human thinking. And then they present data about how people actually think, and they say, well, people don't think the way they're supposed to think, therefore people are irrational. So let's look at the theory behind how people are supposed to think. This is how users make decisions according to game theory and according to economic theory. It's called the economic decision-making model. It assumes that people know what they want and they take the appropriate steps in order to get there. Oh, one thing about these slides is I've put a bunch of stuff in here, which I consider to be interesting stuff, but I'm not going to go through all of the slides because it would be about a two-hour talk. So for people who want the background information, I'll put the slides online and you can read through all the background stuff as well. So anyway, this economic decision-making, that's called subjective expected utility theory. And it makes those assumptions about the decision-making process. It assumes that you've got some sort of utility function so you can evaluate your preferences based on the outcomes of making this decision. It assumes you've got a full and detailed overview of all the possible strategies you can take. It assumes you can estimate the probability of occurrence of all the consequences. And it assumes that you can choose between these alternatives based on any weighting you assign to them. Now, given that this is a room full of computer people, that's the algorithm version of that. So for each possible alternative, you evaluate all possible consequences. And this includes recursive evaluation. So it's not just what happens, but the recursively evaluating sub-consequences and sub-consequences. You assign some sort of probability to that based on, I think this will occur if I do this. You evaluate the subjective utility, which is the utility to me if I make this decision. And then finally, you multiply the probability of the consequences versus the utility. You do that for each possible choice. You pick the highest one. So here's an example of this. Now, this was a certificate dialogue from some years ago because back then, I mean, they've been improved since then. They're still not that good. But this was a, you know, one that's almost perfectly designed for this SEU-based decision making. So, okay, unable to verify this identity of the site as a trusted site. Let's say you want to evaluate one of the possibilities in here. I'm not going to go through all of them because it would take forever, but just one single possibility. So the site certificate is incomplete due to a server misconfiguration. So if you were to apply SEU theory to evaluating this, you would evaluate that based on, for example, the competence of the remote systems administrators, the chances they've made an error, the chances of a software bug, and so on and so forth, all the things that could have caused a problem with the remote site. You then assign probabilities and utilities to each of these. For example, the competence of the admins is, let's say, 0.6. Subjective utility of that is 0.85, and so on and so forth for each of these things. And I'm missing a lot of detail here. Then you assign weights to other factors. For example, are you going there and are you entering your credit card or not? Are you worried about your credit card being phished? Is there a risk of identity theft? There's things like credit card consumer protection. So even if your card gets phished, you've got consumer protection, so it may not be so bad. There's intangible factors. I want to make a purchase. It's my mum's birthday tomorrow. I have to make a purchase. I don't have any choice. And then you get this, as I said, this recursive evaluation of all this stuff. Finally, you go through and calculate all your weights and your measures and probabilities and so on. You do that for each possible option. You pick the most obvious one or the one with the highest weight, and that's the choice you go with. Nobody actually makes decisions like that. Now, remember, the dialogue is designed for that kind of decision making, and yet nobody actually makes decisions like that. This requires total omniscience and total omnipotence. You have to know everything about everything in order to make a decision based on that. So, okay, there's an attempt to patch this. You introduce the concept of a stopping rule. What a stopping rule says is don't go any further when it's obvious that you're not going to get anything out of it. The problem is the way to apply stopping rules is use the SEU model to figure out whether you want to stop or not. A simpler explanation of this is that, you know, why stopping rules can't work is that if stopping rules did work, you can go to Las Vegas and apply the stopping rule, stop playing just before you start losing. They do not work. So how do users actually make decisions? Not how people wish they made decisions, but how do they actually make decisions? Well, there's two ways of looking at this. One is empirical evaluation. So you basically go out and study users and see how they make decisions. The second one is conceptual modeling. So you try and come up with a conceptual model that matches the way that users actually make decisions and see which one best approximates what happens in reality. So in the 1980s, the US Department of Defense sponsored a bunch of research into battlefield decision making. And, you know, they were worried about commanders making bad decisions, which, if you study military history, that's been an ongoing problem. You've got talented commanders who make good decisions and lots of less talented ones who can make some really bad decisions. And what this research found, this was the empirical observation, it found that people don't use anything remotely like the economic decision-making model. People under pressure don't weigh up the outcomes of different decisions. They don't even choose, you know, like, here's the top three and I'll choose the top three. They just say, this one fits best, I'll go with this one. If that doesn't work, I'll go with the next one, and so on. So they generate one option at a time and take the first one that works. And, you know, this is pretty simple to explain. If you're in evolutionary terms, let's say you're a monkey and there's a lion in front of you, you don't say, well, that tree looks good and that one might have thorns on it and that one's a bit further away. You just run up the first tree you can find, because it's a lot better to be wrong than to be eaten. And that's called the singular evaluation model, and a bunch of other names. Researchers have rediscovered this under many different names. So typically this thing is used when you're under pressure. And let's say you're a computer user, again, trying to drift the talk back to computer security. If you're a computer user and you're sitting there and you've got to do a job and you get some dialogue that gets thrown up, you're basically under pressure automatically because you're being prevented from doing your job by this dialogue. So you're pretty much automatically under pressure when something's preventing you from continuing. Conditions are dynamic, so the situation can change by the time you've performed any kind of analysis. And the goals are ill-defined. And again, you get this in computer security. Most users have very little grasp of the implications of any security-related decisions. So if you look at these conditions under which users have to make decisions, it's almost a mirror image of what the ECU model actually expects for decision-making. So other researchers looked at it from a conceptual model, and they wanted to see, you know, which conceptual model best matches the way that humans make decisions. And the best conceptual model was, again, something called singular evaluation, which is just, you know, this one works, I'll try this. Okay, it didn't work, I'll try the next one instead. So both the empirical analysis and the conceptual modeling came to the same conclusion, that heuristic decision making is the best match for how humans, users make decisions. And the reasons why these are popular is that, particularly in the field of security, it's very, very difficult to get any feedback from complex decision-making processes. And the technical term for this is diffusive reinforcement. You make a decision, and it's hard to tell whether there are good or bad consequences from this. For security, it's even worse. There is no feedback whatsoever. You click away a dialogue, and you have no idea whether you've just, you know, signed your life away or whether nothing at all is going to happen. The result of this is something called gambling-based decision-making. So, you know, if you're gambling, even in that case, you're flipping a coin, okay, it might be heads, it might be tails or whatever, at least then you have some feedback. You get this immediate feedback with gambling or with playing poker, with a die roll, whatever. You get immediate feedback. Okay, the decision is uncertain, but right afterwards, you get some feedback saying you've made the right or the wrong decision. In addition, if you take this uncertainty and reduce it to a certainty of a win, then you get this brief sort of cocaine-like high, which is why gambling is actually addictive in the same way that cocaine is addictive for some people. On the other hand, security decision-making, there is no feedback at all. You click away a dialogue. 6 months later, your bank account gets emptied. There is no connection between those two events. They may be connected, they may be totally unconnected. So as far as the user is concerned, any decision they make, they can't tell whether it was a right or a wrong decision. And the consequence of this is that any action that fails to trigger immediate negative feedback is a win. And that's why users dismiss warning dialogues, because they can't get any feedback about the fact whether they've done it right or wrong. They know if they get rid of the dialogue, they can continue doing their job. If they don't get rid of the dialogue, they can't do their job anymore, but it's not obvious that they've been protected from anything. And under these conditions, people's decision-making abilities go downhill quite rapidly. They'll do things like they'll look for some arbitrary distinction. So, you know, you've got two DVD players or Blu-ray players or whatever. And I wasn't aware of Katie's karaoke thing, so I just put this in before knowing about this. But, you know, let's say if you're not Katie and you look at the DVD player and you say, this one's got a karaoke function, this one doesn't, I'll get it with that, even though I don't normally do karaoke. You procrastinate. You decide based on irrational emotions. All these really terrible things. If you're making security-related decisions, these are the worst possible ways that you can actually make a decision. And it's not just strong emotion like job stress. Any form of strong emotion, not just job stress, can cause your decision-making abilities to go downhill rapidly. Any external stimuli, distractions, noisy environment, anything like that. Here's an example of this. Some of the experiments I'm going to mention here were done some time ago when the sort of requirements for human experimentation was a lot more relaxed than they are now. You couldn't do some of these experiments now. So soldiers were in a plane, they'd been trained how to exit a plane safely in terms of parachuting out, and there was this rehearsed conversation between the pilots discussing how the plane was about to crash and they were all going to die. And these soldiers had great difficulty in recalling the instructions they'd been given. There was this external stimulus, the stress, and suddenly their decision-making ability went downhill rapidly. Soldiers who hadn't had that priming about the plane's going to crash didn't have those problems. I'll skip these. There's a couple of slides I'm going to skip. And as I said before, I'll put them online so you can read through all the background detail. The thing is, this is not a bug. It's a feature. Humans need this ability to filter out relevant detail from all the background noise. The entire human information processing system consists of filtering out all the unnecessary garbage and focusing on the few bits that are actually relevant. For example, if you stop for a minute and feel the sensation of the clothes on your skin, which, until I drew your attention to it, you wouldn't have noticed, because your information processing system is designed to filter out unnecessary noise like that. And these allow things like the cocktail party phenomenon, which is you're in a room full of people, everybody's talking, and you can focus on the one conversation you want because your sensory system is able to filter out all the unnecessary background noise. Now imagine if humans couldn't do that. They'd never actually get anything done. Artificial intelligence researchers have run into this. They call it the framing problem. So how do you frame a problem in such a way that it's actually solvable? If you can't frame it appropriately, then the AI will sit there and grind through thousands and thousands of implications and basically not be able to do anything anymore. There's a bunch of theories about what causes OCD. One of the theories is that this is actually a cause of OCD. So basically you've got this labyrinth of implications. You've got every decision you make, you've got so many options that you have to grind through that leads to anxiety, and the sort of reaction to that anxiety is OCD. So that may possibly be a cause of OCD. And I mentioned earlier that various sort of mental disorders are correlated with the way geeks want us to think, and that could be one of them. Researchers have run into this, again, drifting back into security. When they're evaluating browser security indicators, they've run into this analysis paralysis. So what they did is they took a bunch of users and sat them down in front of their browsers and said, we're going to send you to a bunch of sites. Some of them are phishing sites, some of them aren't. And don't just say, this looks okay, I'll go there. Actually examine all the security indicators, do everything you can to verify this site. Now that's the standard best practice advice we give to users. Check certificates, check the padlock, check this, check that. Does it all make sense? So they actually had to abort the experiment. They found that users spent, this is a quote from the original study, absurd amounts of time trying to verify whether the site was legitimate or not. They turned off heuristic reasoning and gone back to this SEU economic decision making. So they had a false positive rate of 63%. Basically, the web would become unusable if we didn't use heuristic reasoning. And even with SEU, even with singular evaluation switched off, they still had a false negative rate of 36%. So it actually made things worse rather than better. Now, there is one small class of people who do actually use the SEU model, and that's people who have sustained damage to the frontal lobes of the brain. That can be either through physical damage, or it can be a viral infection or something like that. Or it's more commonly known as a lobotomy if it's done as a medical procedure. So there's a great report by a neurology professor called Antonio Damasio who talks about this. He had a patient who had damage through some sort of viral infection to the ventromedial prefrontal lobes of his brain. And he asked him, you know, when do you want to come back for next week's appointment? And this guy sat there for half an hour, that's his text there, basically trying to grind through all the possible implications of, shall I come back Thursday, but it might be raining and then I have to catch the bus and the bus could be late. And he sat there for half an hour. He basically couldn't come to any conclusion because he was using the SEU model to try and figure out when he was coming back for his next appointment. And there's also extreme cases of this, extremely rare, but it does occur occasionally, something called somatizing catatonic conversion, in which this analysis paralysis becomes so bad that the patient simply goes completely catatonic. They can't actually make it, they can't get to the point of making one single decision because there are so many implications to work through. So this is not a bug, this is a feature. You need this to function normally. So this is some stuff I'm going to skip. This is some background on evaluating heuristic reasoning, where they compared heuristic reasoning to things like multiple linear regression. And they found out that the heuristic reasoning was actually better than multiple linear regression. For mathematicians, the problem was overfitting. So it took all these completely irrelevant parameters into account, whereas heuristic reasoning just filtered out the most relevant stuff and went with that. Okay, so what do you get once you've, you know, got past this decision-making process? Well, psychologists distinguish two types of actions that occur in response to a situation. So you've been asked to make a decision. There's two types of ways of handling that decision. One is called a control process. It's very slow. It's very costly in terms of mental effort. On the other hand, it provides a huge amount of flexibility because you're sitting there carefully thinking about what you're doing. The other one is an automatic process. It's quick, it's very little mental overhead, and you're basically acting on autopilot. And the advantage of that is because there's little mental overhead, you can do it without even thinking about it. So for example, you've got a novice versus an experienced driver. A novice driver, they've got to think about everything. They've got to think about changing gears, they've got to check their mirrors, look for traffic lights, look for other cars, and so on and so forth. If you've been behind someone with a learner plate on their car, you know that the driving is going to be slow and somewhat erratic because they have to do all this stuff. An experienced driver doesn't have to do that. Everything is completely automatic. A novice driver will deal with this overload of information by load shedding, and thus the not particularly good driving. This is really nasty if it occurs in complex control situations. So if you read stories about sort of, you know, reactor meltdowns and plane crashes and so on, in an aircraft cockpit, there's something called the situational awareness problem. So the pilot loses situational awareness. There are 1,000 alarms going off, and because of that, they're overloaded. They can't focus on the one alarm they need to stop the plane from crashing. So you can actually do this yourself if you want to experience load shedding. Take a piece of paper and just write the weekday on the piece of paper, and at some point start counting backwards from 100 as you're writing the weekday. This is a controlled process, and you're going to be load shedding. Your writing slows down, or your writing quality becomes terrible. Now, if you try an automatic process like signing your name, which you can do without thinking about it, you don't get that much load shedding because there's not that much mental overhead anymore. And these are basically people acting on autopilot. Once you've got the right stimulus, it's very, very difficult to prevent the automatic response from that. And that's why people click away warning dialogues. They've seen warning dialogues, they're basically 100% false positives, or, you know, as the previous slides pointed out, there's no immediate feedback that there's something bad, so they just swat them away. Not only that, but people aren't even aware afterwards that they've done it. For example, for the folks, you know, for the folks in the room at the moment, can you remember actually locking your front door if you have a physical lock on your door? Can you remember actually putting the key in the lock and locking the door, or are you just assuming you lock the door because you always do? It's an automatic process. Or if you drove here, can you remember every traffic light you stopped at, every turn you took, every time you changed lane? Well, most people don't. It's an automatic process. They get in the car, they start thinking about what they're going to be doing on the weekend, and next thing they're at work. And so Microsoft have actually encountered this in the automatic update system. If you look at the automatic updates in earlier versions of Windows, this is a Norton antivirus, but, you know, in earlier versions of Windows, they've become progressively more and more persistent and insistent in making you apply them. This is, you know, from reading some Microsoft blogs, they've said people have gone months without applying updates because every time, this is old, much older versions of Windows, obviously, when the version of Windows popped up a dialogue, they'd swat it away without even thinking about it. And because, and typically infected machines are riddled with adware and pop-ups and so on and so forth anyway, they just see it as another adware pop-up and get rid of it. And that's why more recent versions of Windows have become more insistent in forcing people to reboot, because otherwise the updates never get applied. Now, that occurs outside the computer world as well. For example, UK trains have, for a great many years, at least 100 years, had different levels of automated warning systems. The most recent is something called the AWS, Automated Warning System, and that's it inside the circle there. And the sort of the target-shaped thing at the bottom pops up once you go past a train signal that's set to a danger level. And at that point, the driver has 3 seconds to hit the button underneath it, and if they don't do that, the brakes are automatically applied. So it's basically kind of a dead man switch, that if the driver doesn't say, I'm aware that there's a danger condition, the train is automatically stopped. So the problem is the system had a number of design flaws. One of them was that the indicators had 4 different settings, and yet the automatic warning system only had 1 setting, danger or not danger. And so these danger signs were popping up when the signal actually just indicated a warning like go slow. The result of this is that drivers became habituated in dismissing these things in the same way that users are habituated into clicking away warning dialogues. And there's a technical term for this, signal passed at danger or SPAD. This went on for years and years due to demarcation disputes among unions and all sorts of other stuff. Finally, in 1989, a driver went through 2 of these signals at danger and killed a bunch of people, and that got a lot of media coverage. And because of that, they had to fix it. So here's a design rule. If you've got a security system with a defect so significant it has its own acronym, that's probably a sign that you need to do something about fixing it. Okay, so another thing that we run into is confirmation bias. So basically, humans are very bad at generating testable hypotheses. It's something called confirmation bias. So what happens is users will look at something where there's a question and they will try and prove their theory of how this is supposed to work rather than trying to disprove it. So they'll look for the facts that support the decision they want to make rather than looking for something that doesn't support it. So for example, how do you check whether a website's valid? Well, you enter your username and password, and if it lets you in, it's a proper website. Now, you know, people laugh at this. The thing is, if security geeks had designed the security mechanisms properly and the webs and the server and the client did a mutual challenge authentication, a challenge response authentication, that would be a valid site test. So the problem isn't that users are stupid. The problem is that users are acting in a normal, sensible manner to them, and the underlying software, the underlying crypto, isn't doing what the users want it to do. So the US Navy had this problem in 1988 when they shot down an Iranian civilian airliner. So what happened in this case was there was an airport that was shared between commercial and military traffic, and they could see something taking off. And it could be commercial, it could be military. We'll assume it's military. They saw it was changing height rapidly, so it could be climbing if it's a civilian passenger jet, or it could be descending to attack us. Well, we've already assumed it's a military jet, so we'll also assume that it's descending to attack us. The next thing it's going to do is it's going to either turn away from us, civilian jet, or turn towards us, military jet attacking us. Well, we've already made these previous decisions, so we'll assume it's coming towards us, therefore it's a military jet, we have to shoot it down. And that was confirmation bias, because every step of that process confirmed the existing expectation, and they didn't say, well, wait a minute, what if it's not a military jet? What if it's a civilian jet? What would it do next? So the Navy introduced this thing called the step cycle. So you create a story, which is create a hypothesis. You then test the hypothesis. Is this actually sensible, or is there an alternative story that we could use that is far more valid and plausible? That works for the Navy because they're trained in doing this and they get drilled in this. Unfortunately, for a typical user, you're sitting in front of a confirmation dialogue. You haven't got this Navy training to do it. There's some other things as well. There's disconfirmation bias. It's exactly the opposite. So you've got an invalid but relatively plausible explanation for something, and people are more likely to accept that than a valid but implausible one. So typical example, I've got a web browser, and it looks like my bank site. It's somewhere in Eastern Europe. Well, the browser must be displaying it wrong. And again, that's normal human behavior. That's not some sort of bug in reasoning. So the CIA has got this neat manual called The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis. They ran into this problem where the CIA had this thing called projection bias, or they call it everyone thinks like us bias, where, you know, we're going to do this thing and everyone, it's kind of maybe not terribly ethical or moral to do this, but afterwards everyone's going to say, well, you did the right thing even though it was kind of immoral. And that was a problem that, you know, in terms of, let's say, overthrowing governments and so on and so forth. And they were worried about this because it was kind of making them look bad. And so they published a Psychology of Intelligence Analysis to try and deal with this projection bias. And this is kind of well worth reading. There's a lot of stuff that's not relevant. Some of it is actually very relevant. And it applies very well for computer security. A typical example of this is the other side's authenticated themselves, so from now on we don't need to check anything because they've already authenticated themselves. It's hit a number of SSH implementations, both the client and the server. Okay, the client's entered their password. They wouldn't dream of sending a malformed packet after they've sent their password. Of course, you can do privilege escalation and get root, but people hadn't considered that. Other examples, Unix access control. You check for access to something when you first open it, for example, when you open a file. After that, once the file handle's open, you can do anything you want. A specific example is signed ActiveX controls, but in general, signed anything. It's signed, so it's got to be okay. Well, you either buy a code signing cert from any CA you want, or you steal someone else's code signing cert, and then you've got a signature. So just because it's signed doesn't mean it's okay. Internet kiosks, this is a great example. A lot of PC security is built around the fact that they assume that the user of the computer is on your side. However, with an internet kiosk, the user of the internet kiosk is the enemy. And so there's a bunch of attacks that a user can carry out that simply aren't intended by that attack threat model. There's the entire firewall mentality. It's on port 80, it's got to be okay. So getting back to sort of rationality, once users have made this decision, and once they've used, you know, confirmation bias and disconfirmation bias and whatever to try and adopt a particular belief, they're very, very reluctant to change this belief. This is, if you go back to Gestalt psychology, this is something called Einstellung, so this sort of fixity that I've adopted this decision and I'm not going to change it. Okay, so I'll skip some of these slides again. There's also known as something called the Forer effect. So this is a very famous experiment. A guy called Bertrand Forer in the 1950s gave a bunch of people horoscopes, and they said, we've created these individualized horoscopes for all of you, and we want you to rate how good they are, how applicable they are to you, on a 5-point Likert scale. Now, what a Likert scale is typically people don't like rating in extremes. So people won't rate extremely bad or extremely good. They'll rate towards the middle. It's called the central tendency bias. So what a Likert scale does is compensates for that. So instead of being a rating of 1 to 5, effectively it's a rating of 2 to 4. The average rating these students gave was 4.26, which means it's like incredibly high, again, because people don't like rating at extremes. So they all rated all of these horoscopes, these individual horoscopes, as very, very applicable to them. They'd all been given the same incredibly generic horoscope. It told you nothing about you. It was completely generic. They all rated it as very applicable. Another example of this kind of bias, so professional palm reader. Some researchers went to a professional palm reader, and this palm reader was rated very highly by his clients. And they told him, from now on, tell your clients the exact opposite of what your palm reading actually says. And the clients still rated him extremely highly. And there's a bunch of other stuff like that. Experimental psychologists really like messing with people. But you know, an example of this for yourself, go out and read a description of some new patent medicine or something that's just come out, some new therapy or whatever, and read the symptoms and the things that addresses, and see how many of those symptoms you actually have, meaning you need to go out and get this medicine right now because it needs to cure whatever it is that's wrong with you. So, you know, we sort of laugh at it in terms of palm readers, but then with medicine, with sort of patent medicine, we may go out and do exactly the same thing ourselves. So the reason why we do this sort of stuff is that our brains evolved for survival and reproduction, not necessarily to seek the absolute truth. So quick and dirty techniques work a lot better than sitting there and thinking for half an hour about it while the lion's chewing on you. The result of this is we can rationalize away almost anything. Again, I'll skip this one. But there's a great experiment, again, done about 20 or so years ago, where researchers created these things. They called them inexplicable situations. So it was just two sentences jammed together, no connection whatsoever. Example there, Kenneth made his way to a shop that sold TV sets and Celia had recently had her ears pierced. And then they asked subjects, connect these two, find some reason why these two are connected. And they had 10 seconds. 71% of subjects could find a connection between these two completely randomly chosen unrelated sentences. And so the sort of conclusion from this is that people conduct plausible explanations for something and then continue to believe them, even if they're shown that the evidence for the conclusion is wrong. When they were told these sentences are random, there's no connection, they still believe the connection that they had established. And obviously this plays straight into the hands of con artists and fishers. Here's an example from a fishing study. So humans went to this fishing site and, people that did go to this fishing site, that fell for the fishing sites, were asked, why did you go there? That's all the reasons for them. So, you know, this SSLyahoo.com is a subdirectory of Yahoo. They probably had to register a different site from their brand because it was already taken. Other sites use redirection, so it was okay, and so on and so forth. The thing is, this is normal human behavior. Humans can rationalize away pretty much everything. This isn't stupid users. This is normal users trying to explain the discrepancy between what they're seeing and what they're expecting to see. So here's an extreme example of rationalizing everything. There's a procedure called a corpus callosotomy, or it's more generally known as a split brain, in which people who have extreme epileptic attacks actually have the two hemispheres of their brain separated to try and deal with these extreme epileptic attacks. Now, because the left and right side of the brain process different bits of information, for example, one processes speech, one processes visual information, you can feed one part of the brain information and then ask the other side of the brain why it's doing this based on the information. And the left side of the brain literally has no idea what the right side of the brain is doing. And yet people will still explain it. You know, you feed them information via one side to say, get up and walk around the room. And then you say, why are you walking around the room? Well, my legs must have been stiff. I wanted to stretch my legs. So that's called illusory correlation. People see connections even when there aren't any. I'll skip these ones again. So basically, you've got this sort of self-deception. You can rationalize anything. And again, this is not a bug. This is a psychological defense mechanism. There are people who have a much, much better grasp of reality than people with this high level of self-deception. And that's depressed people. It's called depressive realism. So basically, depressed people suffer from a deficit in self-deception. And their decision-making is much closer to the SEU theory than for non-depressed people. And in sort of neurochemical terms, basically serotonin deficiency, which is associated with depression, gives you a very narrow focus. So you can focus on the thing you actually care about, rather than just using heuristic decision making. Okay, so what about going the other way around? Okay, you know, depressed people have depressive reality. What if we could remove emotions from decision making? Well, okay, that's been not deliberately tried with, but it's people have looked at that as well. So there's a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is it's part of the primitive limbic system, and among other things, it's related to the processing of emotions. And people occasionally have problems with damage to the amygdala, usually due to viral infection or something similar. And you'd think this would be a good thing. This would lead to completely rational, logical decision-making. All emotions are removed from the decision-making process. Well, in practice, it makes people worse decision-makers rather than better decision-makers because they no longer care about what they're making the decision about. And so their decision-making ability goes downhill rapidly. So even removing emotions from decision-making doesn't make it better, it makes it worse. So basically, yeah, these high levels of self-deception, the ability to rationalise away anything, are correlated with notions of good mental health. If you remove the self-deception, then various mental disorders appear. So the problem with this is that, you know, all these fixes, either accidental or deliberate, to self-deception and so on and so forth, no matter what you apply, they end up making things worse rather than better. So basically, the state we exist in now and the state that users exist in now and the way they make decisions is pretty much the optimal state. Okay, so skipping on to something slightly related to that, it's known as the Simon Says problem by usability researchers. So users are required to change their behaviour in the absence of a stimulus. For example, the obvious one is the padlock. If the padlock is not there, the site is not secure. It's well known to social psychologists. It works with experts. If you're an expert, you know exactly what's supposed to be happening, and you notice that if there's some particular stimulus that's missing. If you're a novice user, or even a non-expert user in general, you won't notice that the stimulus is absent. So here's an example. This is, again, a very famous psychology experiment from the early 1960s called the Wason selection task. So a guy called Peter Wason took some subjects and showed them sets of trigrams, basically just cards with letters printed on them, and said all these cards have something in common. And after, on average, going through 34 sets of these cards, they said, okay, all of them there's a letter T in each of these sets. Now, if you reverse that so that they do not have the letter T in there, no matter how many cards people looked at, they could not figure this out. In other words, they were totally unable to detect the absence of a stimulus. But that's exactly what browser UI design expects us to do. We have to detect the absence of a padlock in order to find out that there's a problem. So, yeah, people find negative information very, very difficult to process. Here's an example of this. This is a propositional calculus problem used by psychologists. If today's not Wednesday, then it's not a public holiday. Today's not a public holiday. The question is today not Wednesday? This is the worst way you can possibly phrase this question. There's a bunch of alternatives, generally positive phrasing. All these negatives means that this is the worst possible way in which you can phrase this question. Now consider what browsers ask. If the padlock is not showing, the security is not present. You couldn't actually make this any worse if you tried. So there's something called inattentional blindness, and I think I'm going to skip these slides to let you guys get away for afternoon tea. Again, if you want the background detail behind this, just read the slide. So there's a couple of interesting experiments in this. Although there's one thing I'm going to do, given the audience at the moment. So I'm going to use you as my guinea pigs. So Windows Vista added these UAC dialogues. Could I get a show of hands of people who know that they have different colours for different situations? Okay, keep your hand up if you can explain what the different colours mean. One person, okay.
Did you write the feature?
Yeah, did you write it? Okay. Okay, so basically it's sort of the wrap-up, geeks versus humans. So this leads to a problem. If geeks think that people use heuristic reasoning and all sorts of other stuff, they're very different from normal humans. So the problem is that the geeks who build the software think very differently from the humans who actually use the software. Example of this is brand recognition. Let's say you go into a store and you want to buy a DVD player or Blu-ray player or whatever, Android Media Player. And I've used a DVD player because it's relatively simple and straightforward. So most users will go in there and they say, this is a Philips player or whatever is a major brand in the US. I recognize this brand, I'll buy it. Geeks will look at the Kamikaze player and say it supports all these video formats and you can plug in a USB key and you can plug in SD cards and it's got a Wi-Fi interface and who knows what else. So I'll buy that. That's the economic Bayesian decision-making model. For both sides, that's a great XKCD comic that illustrates that problem. For both sides, this is a perfectly natural, sensible way of reaching a conclusion. For the normal user, they've made a sensible decision. For the geek, they've made a sensible decision. And they've come to exactly the opposite conclusions. So So if you look at this in terms of MBTI traits, there's a psychometric for personality traits called MBTI, Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. It's been superseded by something new called Five Factor, but this is a traditional one that's often used by employers and in employment tests. I've got to add a disclaimer here that this is not actually a personality test. It basically takes Jungian personality types and then bins you into one of them. But employers like it because they say if you've got this personality, you'll be good at doing this sort of thing. There is a particular type called something rather TJ, so there's various characteristics. I won't go into this because it's going to be another half-hour talk. But basically a star TJ personality types, that tends to be the geek personality type. Even more than geek types is computer security people who tend to be int J's specifically, so one very specific personality out of the 16 possible personality types. And again, the disclaimer, the fact that if you're a geek that makes you a star TJ doesn't mean that if you're a star TJ personality type it makes you a good geek. Okay, so why does this make geeks weird? Well, only 7% of the population have that star TJ personality profile, and a minuscule fraction of the population actually have the full int J profile. That means that 93% of the users that geeks are writing software for are completely unlike them in terms of their personality and how they function. There's a neat thing done by a telco overseas where they took their programming and software development and so on department and actually sent them out to do this MBTI test, and they gave them different colored teddy bears based on their personality type. And the entire programming department was a sea of red teddy bears. It was completely uniform personalities, absolutely no difference from int J. So here's a final example of the difference between geeks and normal humans. This is from Aristotelian logic. So all of Anne's children are blonde. Does it follow that some of Anne's children are blonde? And for any logicians in the audience, because I got called on this before, assume that Anne has a non-zero number of children. So this is not a trick question. This question is asking exactly what you think it's asking. Can I get a show of hands of how many people think that if all of Anne's children are blonde, then it follows that some of Anne's children are blonde? Not everyone. Wow. Okay. So for most geeks, this follows. All A are B, then it obviously follows that some A are B. For 70% of normal humans, meaning non-geek humans, when I say normal humans, I mean non-geeks, consider this invalid. And in the psychology jargon, this result is robust. So if you try it across lots of different cultures, if you rephrase this thing any way you want, you get exactly the same response. So basically, a lot of the people creating the software just don't think like the majority of the people that are actually using this. So conclusion, basically humans' minds don't really work the way that most geeks' minds work. And the problem is lots of applications are written by geeks for geeks. Even supposedly user-friendly ones, they're still somewhat too geeky for normal humans to use. The mind works in counterintuitive ways, and as I've shown in the various slides, that's not a bug, that's actually a feature. The mind has to work that way, because if it worked the way that, you know, geeks maybe would like the mind to work, you get all sorts of mental disorders in emerging. And finally, geeks are weird. Okay, so if people want to read the slides with lots more background information, I'll put them up within a couple of days. And finally, there's actually an entire book chapter I've done on this, which gives references and pointers to books and other stuff. I find this stuff really, really fascinating. I'm not sure if it's that fascinating for anyone else, but if you want further reading, there's some pointers to more reading there. Okay, we've still got a couple of minutes. Any questions?
So what do the colors mean?
Sorry?
What do the colors in the UAC dialogue mean?
I actually managed to find it up. It was in some TechNet article buried a long way away from where you'd expect it to be. It was like one of them is like if it's an administratively prohibited action, and one of them if it's a group policy, something or other. I honestly can't remember. Any other questions? Get your UI people to talk to psychologists, to cognitive psychologists. The thing, so at the moment, there's, you know, this is one of these nasty cross-disciplinary fields where if I gave this talk to a bunch of psychologists, I couldn't even give this talk because it's so basic that, you know, for psychologists, this is basic stuff. On the other hand, for geeks, it's not that well known. So get psychologists involved. We have all the psychology research has been done. All the stuff is sitting out there to be used. If you look at what the usability people are doing, they've empirically determined what goes wrong. And in some cases, they look at psychology. But in a lot of cases, you think, you know, this is obvious from a psychological background why this is going wrong. We just need a connection between psychology and usability to figure out what to do next. And, you know, there is a lot of work in psychology where you can look at the paper and say, you know, this is the experiment we did on, you know, we tried this and no one could get it. We rephrased the question this way and suddenly we got a much higher success rate. So the material's out there. It's just a case of digging it up.
So in terms of like the last talk where we see trimming the problem space for the average user so they're just like, okay, I'll use BitLocker and it's one simple thing and it does everything for me. And in this we see like that same kind of theme to a degree where you don't want to overthink things. I feel like, does it get to the point where we're just like, every user trusts anything we throw at them, so why don't we just give them one dialogue to click through? And but you don't really, because then they won't trust us anymore. Where is that sort of divide where we can say, yes, trust us to encrypt everything so that your privacy is maintained, but not to the point where they're like, oh, I've signed my life away because I clicked one thing and it's installed a million other things.
Well, there's a lot of things. We can't fix all the problems all the time, but you know, there are a lot of things that, for example, that web browsers do. If you look at when a web browser throws up a dialogue, it's basically the developer of the browser has given up. He said, I can't make a security decision. I'll just pass it off to the user, and the user can't decide, so they click OK. There's a lot of things where, you know, security software, the security developers should not be allowed to say, I can't be bothered thinking about this. I'm going to pass it off to the user. You're the security developer. You know about, one would hope you know about crypto and security and a bunch of other things. It's your job to solve this, not the user to solve this. And that's, you know, the same thing that Justin said earlier. You shouldn't be exposing 10,000 algorithms to users. Just pick the good one that works and give them that. An example, you know, of a crypto product that is astoundingly successful is Skype. Because you don't even know it's a crypto product. You set it up, and you type in your name, and you sign on, and that's it, and it's working, and you've got encryption. Now, you've got national security leaders and who knows what, which is another matter. But for the general attackers, you've got strong crypto protecting you without you even knowing that you've got the strong crypto.
Okay. So I have a question kind of in the same field. The thing is, you mentioned, right, there's like normal users, they take in signals. And there are multiple signals at the same time, right? And to build on the previous speaker, right? If we make it so simple, so it's intuitive, and people implicitly trust Microsoft to do the right thing, at the same time, there is a whole technology blogs field, right? That will just bombard, not including those features and options and ability to modify stuff. And they'll just, okay, this is not security product at all because you cannot select a different encryption. Well, and so now user has two signals pretty much. One is they kind of trust Microsoft. Second, they hear everywhere that it's not good enough. And how do you solve it?
Yeah, and that's sort of the geek problem. You're dealing with, you know, a vast mass of users who really need to be secured because they're not geeks, and then a small number of geeks who can probably secure themselves anyway, but who are going to shout very loudly if you don't give them their favorite cipher. The only obvious thing is that, you know, to do basically what the UAC dialogues do, where you've got this thing to click on to say more information, and you've got all the geeky information at the bottom. So for normal users, they're never going to click on, and again, this is something I didn't have time for in the slides, but there's sort of an economic theory that defaults are basically a form of de facto regulation, that most users never change their defaults. So whatever you choose as the default, most users are never going to change that, and then give them some sort of expert mode or whatever if they're a geek so they can change all the nonsense they want. Heck, I mean, if I was doing that, I'd let them change anything and just use AES anyway, just so that, you know, give them lots of dials and levers to fiddle with and just give them AES. But yeah, you may not get away with that. You can deal with the sort of the people who shout loudest while using sensible defaults for the people who just want to be secure and don't care about all the stupid options.
I'm here.
Yep.
So My question is regarding the relevance of the research presented, different studies presented to today's generation, I suppose. So it's been widely believed that millennials onwards, the sort of thinking they have, the sort of data they need to make a decision is different. In a lot of ways, maybe they are more geek than their elderly counterparts. Do you see a different outcome for these studies if they were done today?
So some of the fundamental studies, and you know, for example, the ones that I mentioned that were robust have been done across different cultures, different time periods, and so on. Others, because they're evaluating fundamental human things that have probably been like that for 10,000 years. Others, it's very hard to tell. You know, for example, we know that, and if you look at things like privacy, what teenage kids are worried about in terms of privacy threats, they're not worried about the NSA, they're not worried about the government, they're worried about their parents. That is the single biggest privacy threat on Facebook, because their parents are going to read that they got drunk last night when they shouldn't have. So there are some changes in the high-level abstract stuff, so let's say privacy concerns. But I think the fundamental underlying stuff, like, you know, confirmation bias, it's been that way pretty much forever, and I can't see that changing.
Thank you.
And I think we're out of time. I'll be around afterwards if people want to ask me more questions.
One more.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Are there any studies that kind of go on? We've talked about how users go through that initial rationalization, the monkey and the lion type of situation. What about after they've got, for example, negative stimuli? For example, we're in a cloud world now. Everybody's going there and trusting the website, clicking, yeah, I'm trying to buy something. I'm trying to use a cloud service. And then that is betrayed in some way. For example, PlayStation's problem they had a few years ago. Are there any studies about that, how users or people in general integrate that into their behaviors, and what do they do?
I don't know of any studies from the psychology field. There's been the sort of the X stages of grief kind of thing analysis, but I'm not aware of any psychology studies of the feedback. So studies have been done by usability people, which is more empirical, rather than the cognitive psychology, which is, you know, we have this mental model of how users are supposed to react, and have they actually done this. So I'm not aware of psychology studies, only usability studies.